Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the conflict in Afghanistan has transformed with the United States withdrawal. We examine why the government fell and the impact on the country and the region. Doug Becker explores these questions and more.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the U.S. formally began withdrawal from Afghanistan, the nation has witnessed an incredibly rapid deterioration of the government's position. President Ashraf Ghani has fled the nation, and the opposition Taliban are poised to control the nation upon the completion of this U.S. withdrawal. Why has the government fallen so quickly? What are the implications of the return of the Taliban to power? Refugee flows out of the nation have profound challenges for receiving nations, Western countries receiving them, and potentially neighboring countries in Central Asia also receiving them. And of course, threats from terror networks remain. On today's show, we are examining the conflict in Afghanistan and its implications on the region and the world. Our panel is Amin Tarzai, Director of Middle East Studies at the Marine Corps University. He is the author of Islamic State, Khorasan Province in The Future of ISIS. Robert Cruz, Professor of History at Stanford University. He is the author of Afghan Modern, The History of a Global Nation. Thomas Johnson, Research Professor of the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval Postgraduate School, as well as the Director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies. He is the author of Taliban Narratives, The Uses and Power of Stories in the Afghanistan Conflict. And Steve Swerdlow, Associate Professor of the Practice at the University of Southern California. He was Senior Central Asia Researcher at Human Rights Watch and has conducted extensive fieldwork internationally with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. Thank you all for joining us. And Amin Tarzai, I will start with you. The government failed rapidly in Afghanistan, and I know there was some pessimism about the government's ability to survive a U.S. withdrawal, but was this rapid deterioration something that seemed to be on the horizon? Was it predictable? And what are some of the reasons why it fell apart so quickly?
Thank you very much. Before I say anything, I just want to say that I once wore the uniform of the United States Marine Corps, and today I work with that organization. We have lost 11 Marines and one Navy corpsman, so I salute all of them and my condolences to their families if they hear that, this program. Your question, Doug, is twofold. The first aspect of it is the Afghan government that was in power until Ashraf Ghani escaped was a system that was put together as an expediency by the United States and other Western countries to go out. That government was put together outside of the Afghan constitution, number one, the position of CEO, chief executive officer, or later on the chief of negotiations or peace does not exist in the Afghan constitution, yet that was the number two person, the person of Dr. Abdullah Abdullah. What I'm trying to say is that the government was created not to help or serve Afghanistan, but rather to be a fig leaf for the West to withdraw after 2014. That government never really became a government. I am on record saying, paraphrasing Voltaire, who was talking about the Holy Roman Empire, I said the national unity government of Afghanistan was neither national, united, nor a government. And I still stand by that. That is the first thing. The years between 2014 until today, the Western supporters and other supporters of the Afghan government really did not pay attention to that government. Nobody enforced even the agreement that was stated. Dr. Ghani and Dr. Abdullah were supposed to work together. They never did, mostly because Ghani was a person who wanted power for himself. So the government was put, as I said, as an expediency outside of Afghan constitution, and it never functioned even on that basis of the agreement that was signed by Ghani and Abdullah at the persuasion of then Secretary of State of the United States, Mr. Kerry. So that is the nexus of it. it never really became a government. And you saw the collapse of that when Ghani escaped instead of staying the course to follow through to an agreement of handover of power. Abdullah at least stayed and is trying to do something. That is the first part of it. The second part is this whole military aspect. We keep on hearing about 300,000 forces. That is not actually true. The numbers are much lower because a lot of these were ghost soldiers, meaning the soldiers didn't exist. Some of them, the commanders, unfortunately, there's where corruption and nepotism and all that come from. This is not the fault of the West. This is the fault of the Afghan side. What they were doing is they were reporting much higher numbers, and the troop numbers were very much smaller. Also, the money that came into the troops was shared by the commanders before it ever got to the troops. Some troops were never paid. They were never paid. Their weapons, the ammunition was actually stolen and sold outside, sometimes to the Taliban. These have been recorded, but it was never really paid attention to. It was recorded by US government agencies. What was on paper was not on reality. But whatever was on the ground, they fought bravely. They have lost more than 60,000 troops fighting with our forces. But as I say, the leadership, especially the political leadership, the president being, you know, commander-in-chief, never really connected with the people, and the government was very weak. And the last part is, when we were leaving, the Afghan forces were fully dependent on the United States for air support, intelligence gathering, logistics, and moral support. It was the idea that the US is there. If something goes wrong, we will help them. And they fought until the last day. They fought in Lashkar Gah while we were even that small number of the US forces that were on the ground. By us withdrawing, they never had that support, and their own president escaped. So that's where the collapse comes in. And another aspect is the contractors. In future wars, in future conflicts, even future American involvement outside the world, we should look at this whole over-reliance on contractors. We not only left, but we pulled the contractors out, which meant what? The maintenance of the Afghan Armed Forces aircraft, the helicopters mainly, and then some of the aircraft we had, all of that suddenly stopped. Even their communication was based on contracts helping them. So these are the reasons there. Of course, the other reasons are what the Taliban did, but I'll leave that in the next part of our discussion. Thank you.
And since that's a wonderful transition, Thomas Johnson, I know you've written about the Taliban. So that's going to be a part of this equation. Some of this is the failure of the government, but also the success of the Taliban. What's really contributed to the Taliban's success?
Well, if I can, I'd first like to expand on a couple of dynamics that my good friend Amin Tarzai brought up. I was surprised that the Ghani government lasted as long as it did. Both in 2014 and 2019, he actually lost the elections to Abdullah Abdullah. I published extensively on this. And I mean, just to give you a fast example about 2014, at that time, an Afghan ballot box could contain 600 ballots. Now, in the rural areas, a polling place usually consisted of only one ballot box. In the urban areas, of course, the polling places contained a lot of ballot boxes. I received all of the official Afghan ballot information and data for every district, for every polling place. And my first assessment was that I found out that Ghani got 600, in 606 ballot boxes, Ghani got 600 votes, Abdullah Abdullah, none, zero. And in another 560 ballot boxes, Ghani got all but 5% of the vote. Now, this is obviously impossible statistically, and just showed the magnitude of what the Afghans call sheep stuffing. And, you know, I exposed this. Ghani basically made me persona non grata, and I couldn't come back to Afghanistan once it was published in Dari. But he was fraudulent. The other thing that Amin talked about is that the corruption was just immense. But ultimately, the thing that really brought Ghani down was his lack of legitimacy. You know, the last poll I saw, he had less than about 25% legitimacy. I'm not talking about popularity. I'm talking about legitimacy. And if you take a look at theorists of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and I think Mao was one of the best theorists in this area, Mao said that it only took two things for an insurgency to be successful: to have a regime that had less than 80% legitimacy and also had 15% of the population support. And, you know, both of those were true in Afghanistan. I'll get to the Taliban in a second, but I also want to talk a little about, I think everyone should pay close attention to Greg Whitlock's book, The Afghanistan Papers, that's going to be published on August 31st. We were not told the truth for years about the capability and the size of the Afghan National Defense Forces. Now, relative to the AMP, they were basically useless because they were an extractive organization. Throughout history, constabulary and police units play an important role in counterinsurgency. But in the case of Afghanistan, the Afghan National Police were literally the most hated institution in many parts of the country. I was seconded to the Canadian Army to serve as the commander's, General Vance's, senior political officer and COIN advisor. And, you know, I have a lot of friends in Kandahar. And one of the questions that was always asked to me, how can I get my cousin's motorcycle back that was stolen by the Afghan National Police? And of course, you never could. But also 33% of the Afghan National Police never received any formal training. So they can be basically reduced or eliminated from the algorithm relative to fighting the Taliban. The ANA, and I still get extremely upset, and Amin surely pointed to this. We still have pundits on television that are suggesting that the Afghan National Defense Force, both the combination of the Afghan National Police and the Afghan National Army, was as large as 375,000. Craig Whitlock, in the Afghanistan Papers, will show how misleading that's been. I estimate, and people that know the subject better than I, estimate that when the Taliban attacked in earnest, you know, about a month ago, there was maybe 50 to 60 Afghan National Army soldiers under arms. And while they improved a lot after our basic withdrawal in 2004, let me just tell you one thing. In 2004, along the Jalalabad Road to Kabul, where most of the training bases were, we had a metric that we used to evaluate each trained unit, with one being they couldn't do anything independently, they couldn't even feed themselves, to four, they can do everything independently. In 2014, after training, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Afghan National Army. And you have to also understand that the ANA had a 33% non-recruitment and desertion rate every year. Only three units received either a three or a four, only three. Now, their capabilities increased greatly over the years after our withdrawal, but they were still very weak and their capabilities were greatly exaggerated. Our special forces continued to train the Afghan special forces, and they had some good units, but their capabilities were also greatly exaggerated. And plus, they were made up of a lot of minorities. The only thing worse than an American or NATO soldier coming in the middle of the night and knocking down a wall or a door and bringing all the people of that compound, Kalat, out into the public, women in their bedclothes. The only thing worse than that would be a Hazara doing that. And so the special forces faced that. But to get back to your original question on the Taliban, and I hate this expression because it's used so often, but they had a time while we had the watches. They would be willing to fight for 50 additional years to achieve their goals. And their goals, as stated before the political theater of Doha, their non-negotiable demands were stated by Berader's assistant, who said that one, the reestablishment of the Afghan emirate, and two, the reinstitution of their view of radical Deobandi Sharia law. Now, of course, you know, the reformulation of the emirate ends the Afghan republic, basically. But the Taliban also greatly increased the numbers of soldiers that they had on ground. Up until a couple of years ago, if somebody asked me how many Taliban were in the country, I'd say, first of all, they'll put as many in the country as they need to accomplish their goals. And that was usually between 25 and 30,000. But this year, you saw an influx of about 85,000 Taliban. And it was clear that they were moving into a different phase of the conflict. And I don't know how true the reports are, but they also suggest that they were supported by 10,000 non-Afghans that were fighting with them. And I can't confirm how truthful that is. So, I mean, the staying power of the Taliban was the key thing, Doug. And we have four-year election cycles. They knew that. The only reason they participated in the theater at Doha in the first place was to extend it long enough to be able to see how Biden was going to respond to the absolutely ridiculous historic peace agreement announced by Zalmay Khalilzad on February 29th of 2020. It was never a peace accord. It was basically a plan for a phase withdrawal. So, you know, my bottom line is that the Taliban had the time, they had the morale, they had the armaments that they needed, and they had the public support to be able to do what they, take Kabul basically in 11 days.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the conflict in Afghanistan, the U.S. withdrawal, and the implications for the country and the region with Amin Tarzai of the Marine Corps University, Thomas Johnson of the Naval Postgraduate School, Robert Cruz of Stanford University, and Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California. So Robert Cruz, I'd like to bring you in on this as well. There seems to be at least some narrative here that the fall of the Ghani government and the rise of the Taliban was somewhat inevitable. Has this outcome sort of been written for a long time, and the only question was the timing?
Thank you for the question, and thanks for having me. And I defer to your esteemed guests, who are good friends and far more knowledgeable about so many of these subjects. So, if you'll bear with me, I guess my point of view would be complimentary, I suppose. But I think we could draw two of your last questions together and see a kind of dynamic interplay between, on the one hand, the success of Taliban diplomacy. If we think of the strengths of the Taliban being really multiple, as Tom Johnson pointed out, always, that we've, I think for two decades now, underestimated. But I think that the Taliban have been good at a number of things. And one of them I would highlight for us would be as diplomats. They skillfully used, targeted assassinations, bombings, terror. But, I think as Tom was suggesting, they ran circles around Mike Pompeo's team at Doha. And I think as they garnered some degree of attention and of, diplomatic standing and arguably of legitimacy in Doha in negotiating with Americans, I think that had a kind of cascade effect in that they soon received invitations to attend meetings in Moscow, in Beijing, and they long had crucial support from Islamabad, of course. But some of our colleagues believe that they also had an expanding network of ties that included Iran, in addition to the kind of solid base of support in Pakistan. So I think what the Trump administration did inadvertently, and your listeners will recall that there was even an idea floated from the White House that they would the Taliban would be invited to attend some kind of ceremony at Camp David. So like all this, that invitation never formally materialized, but I think even speaking about it, alarmed a lot of people. And I think really conferred a degree of normalcy or even legitimacy to the movement, which simultaneously had a kind of deflating effect. I think this is what Amin was speaking of, the psychological effect of being crucially excluded from the Doha Agreement, elevated the Taliban as the key actor with which all the great powers had to deal, at the same time that Washington was marginalizing the government of Ashraf Ghani for various reasons. So I think that was a kind of codependency or a kind of symbiotic effect of the elevation of one party and the deflation of the other, which has had all kinds of consequences that fed into the apparently, yeah, the sudden collapse. And I think another feature of the Taliban effort here was that in claiming to be the voice of the Afghan people in appearing in these different diplomatic venues, they always insisted on being spoken of as a state, as the Islamic Emirate. And I think, you know, you'll recall back in the day, I think under Obama around 2009, the British and Americans spoke of, you know, bringing the state in a box to the southern province of Helmand as part of a counterinsurgency effort. I think it's important to recall that the Taliban always projected themselves as early as 2002, 2003 in making their resurgence, that they too reflected essentially an alternative state vision. This meant shadow courts, shadow governors, but abstractly, especially as their social media campaign became more sophisticated, they projected this image of a state in the waiting of an emirate, you know, with a different name, different flag, different symbolism. On their website, you know, they boasted of having alternative state institutions, commissions that would replicate the duties of the existing Afghan ministerial system, but in their version, do this all more efficiently, do this with greater attention to justice. And so this kind of state in a box that the emirate projected in various capitals, I think had a kind of deflating effect on the actual holders of Afghan state positions. And this capacity to always insist upon being a state in exile was very effective in changing how people responded to a moment of crisis. And then as Amin noted, and as Tom noted, as US forces retreated and as people, you know, were forced to make a decision about whether to fight, you know, whether to flee, you know, how to survive, given, you know, that very, you know, rapid series of events, all of this, I think, came to weigh on lots of Afghan politicians and, of course, on the fighting forces. And so I think that's partly that the structure here is one that Washington created, the dynamic, the kind of, you know, undermining its supposed partner while bolstering its supposed enemy at Doha, has had multiple effects that we're only beginning to understand.
Doug, could I just have a few minutes very shortly to expand? Okay, one of the things that your listeners have to also understand, that we have a COIN manual. Initially, it was Army FM 3-24. It was rewritten 6 times. It's now Joint Publication 3-24.
Let me jump in just quickly. COIN stands for counterinsurgency, correct?
Counterinsurgency, yes. In fact, it was written when Crystal was at Leavenworth running TRADOC. But anyway, the point that I want to make is that in that manual, it suggests that a counterinsurgency and also an insurgency is 80% informational or political and only 20% military kinetic. And I also think the Taliban recognized that much better than we did. And that's why I wrote the book, Taliban Narratives. Their narratives, their stories, their propaganda was brilliant. It might not be true, but it was brilliant to be able to bring the rural population to them. Maybe we can get into it in a little more detail later, but I did want to raise that. And our information campaign was terrible.
No, absolutely. Those issues, we certainly got to go into more detail about that, but I'd like to bring Steve Swerdlow into the conversation. Steve, you take a little bit of a different position in that, you know, your area of expertise is more the regional expertise, but kind of as a nice follow-up to Bob's comments about diplomacy, very little of the American conversation has been about the role that Russia could potentially play and the role that the Central Asian republics that neighbor Afghanistan can play. So could you tell us what kind of role that they could play and what kind of role that they have played?
Sure. No, and I'm learning so much from this panel, and I'm not an Afghanistan expert. I'm a human rights expert and a Central Asianist. And, you know, I am looking at what's happening with refugee flows. Obviously, you know, from the first days, I was thinking about how would those states that are directly north of Afghanistan react? What would they do? And very problematically for potential refugees, you know, thousands or more seeking to cross north, is that Uzbekistan, the biggest player of the 5 Central Asian states, the most powerful militarily, has quite controversially never signed the Refugee Convention. So it technically, legally speaking, can turn people back and say, we have no obligation. And in fact, in the months leading up to the withdrawal, the U.S. was frantically trying to get agreement with the Uzbeks to provide temporary, at least temporary shelter for interpreters and translators to be housed there while they wait for resettlement. Of course, you know, all this rendered in some sense moot by August 15th and this intensely tragic turn of events over the past several days. But Uzbekistan has placed its foot in the ground for, again, somewhat rational reasons. They were walking this line in terms of non-recognition of the Taliban and the ethnic relationship between the Uzbeks of northern Afghanistan and the regime, the government in Tashkent, makes this all a really complicated calculation. But from a human rights perspective, it's absolutely shameful and unacceptable that a state would continue not to sign the Refugee Convention and not play this role. So we've got Uzbekistan doing that. In fact, I should say they've returned refugees. There have been reports already. And there was a very sort of cryptic statement they issued their foreign ministry in Tashkent saying that they had received assurances from the Taliban that the Afghans they returned would not be harmed. So this false notion that there could be credible diplomatic assurances from the Taliban not to violate human rights of the people that are coming back is it's laughable and it's really worrying and difficult. Then to the east of Uzbekistan, a little bit further along the border, of course, you have Tajikistan. Now, they said that they would take up to 100,000 refugees. And it's good that they made that promise. But as of yet, we haven't really seen evidence that the Tajik government is receiving refugees. And they're incredibly nervous about, in fact, it's Tajikistan that's been most explicit about so far not recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate government. They've been, in a way, Rasmon, the longstanding dictator of Tajikistan, made an interesting statement in which he said he wishes Afghanistan peace, but he can't recognize the Taliban unless an inclusive government is formed that recognizes the rights or acknowledges the rights and is representative for the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, and other ethnic minorities. Obviously, the relationship between the Tajiks in Tajikistan and the Tajiks in Afghanistan, very complicated, but it's rare. It's rare to see a post-Soviet autocrat get so undiplomatic about this and sort of, I wouldn't say it's a salvo against the Taliban, but at least it's an indication that this is going to be a rocky road and that Tajikistan fears perhaps being drawn into military operations. When you meet with a lot of Tajiks, this isn't necessarily uniform, but a lot of Tajiks in Tajikistan feel a lot of solidarity for Ahmed Massoud leading now the insurgency or the resistance in Panjshir Valley. Then you have Turkmenistan on the other side of Uzbekistan, which has been doing the opposite. They've been negotiating with the Taliban. By my count, they met with the Taliban before the takeover at least three or four times, usually with Moscow involved, doing that sometimes in Moscow, sometimes in Ashgabat. And they also have not been upholding their human rights obligations to provide safe haven. So when you combine the behavior of the Central Asian governments with Pakistan and Iran, and then China, of course, seeking to have agreements with the Taliban about ethnic Uyghurs, not even Chinese nationals, but maybe even Afghan nationals, Uyghurs being sent out of the country to China in order to secure, you know, sort of lock down that eventuality or possibility of an Uyghur resistance from Afghanistan, you see a really bad picture. So the focus in the media has, of course, understandably been about the U.S. evacuation effort of refugees, which has been, you know, obviously not happening nearly as fast as it should. But I think we have to remain very vigilant and focused on the obligations of all the states around Afghanistan to protect human rights, uphold human rights. And I'll end this little soliloquy with the latest news from the Human Rights Council, where human rights organizations and a lot of governments were calling on the council to create a mechanism to monitor not just the refugee situation, but obviously rights for women and girls, to monitor the Taliban as stringently as is possible through diplomatic means, whatever that means. But unfortunately, the UN Human Rights Council, as it often does, did not come together. And you had Pakistan, I think it was, advancing a resolution which was fairly watered down. So you don't have a mechanism in international practice right now to really watch what happens to people's rights.
I mean, Tarzai, I know on a day like today, when we're recording, of course, We are learning the news of explosions, people killed, you know, near the airport and in other places around the country. And it was a reminder that there are security risks, certainly with respect to the U.S. withdrawal and future security risks. Now, at this point, I don't know if they've attributed the attack, but there's certainly been concerns of the ISIS organization, the so-called ISIS-K, or was it ISIS Khorasan? And I mean, I know you've written about this. Could you tell us a little bit about this organization? What kind of threat this organization might pose?
ISIS, which is called Islamic State in Khorasan province. Khorasan goes back to the early Islamic empires. It was a province of the Abbasid Empire, and it encompasses part of Afghanistan, northeastern Iran, and parts of Central Asia. But when they say Khorasan, they mean Pakistan, Afghanistan mainly, but sometimes India. They have claimed responsibility officially. They have even put a picture of the person who, at least as far as they're claiming, conducted the suicide bombing. I will not name him. I will not honor him. His name is there. His picture is there. So they have indeed claimed responsibility. Who is the ISKP or Islamic State Khorasan province? They are an offshoot of the ISIS that came out in Iraq and in Syria of Islamic State. Their relationship with Baghdad and Syria is pretty loose. They are more inspirational leadership there than it is a functional leadership. They mostly come from Pakistan. Individuals, there are some Afghans, Pakistanis, there are some Uyghurs, you just mentioned right now, Steve said it. There are some Uzbeks from what used to be IMU, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, the Eastern Turkestan movement. So there are Central Asians among them. The core is Pakistani. There are Arabs in them too. Some disgruntled Taliban are there. They came out mainly after the Tahrik Taliban Pakistan was pushed out into Afghanistan. Their birthplace is in the eastern province of Afghanistan called Konar. And then they actually for a while had established themselves in 2015 in Konar and Nangarhar, which is again another eastern province. They have never had a good relationship with the Taliban from day one. One thing that you heard again, I think Steve mentioned it and Bob mentioned it well, that the Taliban were in this diplomatic charm offensive. One reason that countries such as Russia, China, Iran became, and then some of the Central Asian countries, Turkmenistan included, became friendly with the Taliban or accepted Taliban as a reality was because they were against ISIS. The Taliban were regarded to a large degree correctly as a more national movement, whereas ISKP, as the name suggests, has an internationalist agenda. They want to cross the borders. They actually want to eliminate the borders and actually reach out. And this is why you hear in the US right now, people are saying that the Taliban and ISKP were enemies, which is a truth. Actually, it was the Taliban mostly that did the biggest damage to the ISKP. They were the Afghan military. The US did a lot of work on them, but the Taliban were against them. It, as I have written in that piece that you mentioned, that's from 2018, they were never eliminated. They lost their territorial state, if you would, or their territorial presence, mainly in the eastern part of Afghanistan, but they dispersed. And some of them were in jail, which were they were released when the Taliban came in. I have always said then, and I say today, that their danger remains. Their danger is significant. They're not like the Taliban are trying to be legitimized. Their legitimacy is in sheer violence, and because they don't have any other legitimacy. There's no popular support in Afghanistan for them. I would not see even Pakistan. They have very small support. So the terror, sheer terror becomes their main objective. We in the United States and elsewhere, countries around especially, will have to deal with this phenomena. It's very elusive. Of course, the question is, can we do anything when we don't have a presence? We don't have an intelligence gathering presence. We don't have a military. And over the horizons, Pakistan has to acquiesce. Otherwise, we can't get there. But I leave that to my other colleagues. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And Steve Swerdlow, I mean, Tarzai just, you know, highlighted this ISIS-KP, you know, organization certainly doesn't have a respect for borders and maybe is trying to extend this. This should probably have profound implications for the region.
Yeah, I was just going to quickly ask Amin and others as well, do you think there's credible evidence that they would have designs, that ISIS-K would have designs on the Central Asians? Of course, as you rightly said, there was an IMU component, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. And of course, there's talk in Central Asia, fears of a Taliban incursion. But I'm just curious whether or not you see any evidence because of the presence of not just ethnic and Tajiks and Uzbeks in the group, but also even some foreign nationals that fled a long time ago from Central Asia to Afghanistan and formed terrorist organizations. Do you see any evidence of them actually wanting to cross north and invade?
Well, that's what they claim. If you look at their map, they have a map. It includes all of Central Asia. And in my piece, I have written about how they use it. And then I published something else in the recently in an Encyclopedia of Iranian Studies on what Khorasan means. They're playing with an historic term, but if you look at their map that they have on their website, again, I will not mention that, but they have a website, and that map includes all of the five countries of Central Asia. It includes, very importantly, Sinkiang province. It includes northern India and all of Pakistan and part of Iran, not all of Iran. They're very interesting, not part of Iran, all of Afghanistan, all of Pakistan and India. You're right. Actually, I have heard from people on the ground in Afghanistan that there are people in Kabul who nobody knows what their languages speak. Afghans will, of course, understand all of their local languages and Urdu. They are speaking something very different. So it could be the Chechens, could be the Uyghurs. So yes, Central Asia will be one of their main targets. The other target they have is Kashmir. And those are the two main ones that they talk about.
And Thomas Johnson, you wanted to jump into the conversation as well.
I think it's important to recognize that, at least according to the data I've seen, Steve might correct me on this, but for ISIS fighting in Syria, Central Asia supplied the most fighters of any region in the world. It's estimated that 5,000 Central Asians went down and fought in Syria. But the interesting thing about the Central Asians fighting in Syria, they didn't only bring themselves, but they brought their entire families. And I've been told by numerous sources in Central Asia that there are presently, now most of these people were killed, but the families weren't. And as the sons grow older, they can become very, problematic. But I've been told by my sources in Central Asia that there are sleeper cells everywhere for, ISK. When ISK first appeared in Afghanistan, about 4 years ago, and many of them came from Pakistan, I always felt that Central Asia was their real goal. Because, there's changes in Uzbekistan going on right now, but it's hard to debate with the point that at least the other four states, and to a certain extent still Uzbekistan, are police states that have never allowed for any type of, Islamic politics to play a role. So I've always thought that ISIS really wanted to look into Central Asia, not only because of the sleeper cells, but because of the composition and the policies that have reigned ever since the five countries got their independence in 1991.
Steve Swerdlow, you want to respond to that?
Amin was saying that Tunisia was the largest supplier of fighters, but you're absolutely right. 5,000 were estimated Central Asians to be in Iraq and Syria. And now there's a really interesting situation of the repatriation of a lot of those families back to Central Asia, back to the Central Asian governments. But I think Thomas's point is right, which is the assertive secularism of these majority Muslim governments in Central Asia is a target. But it's interesting to hear how you both view it, because from my perspective, looking from Central Asia at Afghanistan, it's more the case usually that the dictators and the autocrats in Central Asia are playing up a threat, exaggerating a threat in order to crack down on human rights inside the country. And as like Thomas said, not allow religious freedom or political Islam to exist in any way.
Absolutely. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the future of Afghanistan with Amin Tarzai of Marine Corps University, Thomas Johnson of the Naval Postgraduate School, Robert Cruz of Stanford University, and Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California. And Robert Cruz, like to turn to you, especially, you've I've written about Afghanistan as a modern nation, as a global nation. I know ethnic identity certainly has driven conflict in Afghanistan throughout, you know, a big chunk of its history. How much is there a real threat of this ethnic conflict? And also, I guess broadly, is this conflict, at least in part, the future of this conflict of a Taliban that represents an Afghan, you know, a desire for some sort of an Afghan identity versus this ISIS-K or ISKP that's much more international in its approach?
Thank you. I mean, that's a very challenging question, but an important one. I mean, the place of ethnicity in the whole Taliban phenomenon is important. I mean, maybe it's useful to start with their claim. I mean, the Taliban have long claimed in public that they represent everyone, right? That they represent Islam, that they are, in effect, uninterested in ethnicity per se, and that they represent Islam, they represent all Afghans, and as others noted, they represent a national framework for politics. So in their defense, they've long claimed, you know, we're distinct from other more internationalist thinking, you know, Islamist groups. We really just are devoted to Afghan sovereignty, to really just ruling Afghanistan. So don't worry about our international ties, like with Al-Qaeda. You know, don't worry about our designs in other territories. But in practice, you know, it's more complicated because many Afghans see them through the lens of ethnicity. They see them primarily as a Pashtun fighting force. And many people see them as essentially a kind of ethno-nationalist movement. And again, they deflect that kind of attribution. And they also argue themselves that, you know, they're not a tribal movement. President Biden today observed that, you know, Afghanistan's always been, you know, this place of tribes that have never gotten along with one another. And of course, that's to all of us here, I think it's an alarming misreading of Afghan history and politics. But the element of tribe, you know, can be exaggerated as a kind of organizational force for Afghan politics, but it is meaningful for some communities. And the Taliban have done this, have I think long pursued an interesting strategy of attempting to draw members from different Pashtun communities who affiliate with different kind of tribal organizations. And here, you know, tribe, I think all of us could probably say something different about that, but I think it might be useful for your listeners to try to conceive of tribe in this context, not as something that determines people's politics and choices, but really as a kind of identification which coexists alongside other modes of identification, and which is also historically contingent and situational. So I don't know if Steve Sverdlov has ever heard this formulation, but there's a great scholar from the North Caucasus who, in trying to explain these kinds of affiliations there, he's likened, you know, the notion of tribe in the North Caucasus to, you know, something like an American alumni network. So you have an affiliation with, you know, USC or with the University of Arizona or with University of Florida. And it's one important part of your identity, but it doesn't displace all others. So in Afghanistan, you know, there are communities that imagine, you know, they have a past, a shared genealogy, and it creates certain kinds of affinities. But it's important, I think, to put them in play with all kinds of other issues. I mean, I think, you know, Tom's reference to people he's met who, you know, had their bike stolen and they want it back from the police. I mean, there are things in which those networks that we may, you know, identify as being family or genealogy, the larger community, might be operated in a moment when you want to get your bike back. But again, it doesn't mean that defines every aspect of your life. At a time when, you know, in modern times, Afghans have been displaced, you know, around the planet, they have been exposed to modern politics. I think, Doug, this is where I would, you know, emphasize this kind of tension that we have in our imagination between tribe and modernity. But I would suggest that, you know, we tend to look at tribe as being something primitive and unmodern or anti-modern, something that is kind of outside of modern politics. But I would suggest instead that most Afghans, especially in modern cities, have been exposed, especially in the last two decades, to all kinds of phenomena which, you know, are the stuff of modern politics, of mass media, of claims of development, of ideologies, from everything from what we might call social democracy or Marxism-Leninism back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, to, you know, kind of progressive green politics, to, you know, attention to climate change, to secularism, even to atheism. So there's actually been, in the last two decades, the emergence of a very pluralistic kind of political landscape. And for some, yes, you know, your family, that matters. You know, sometimes, you know, understandings of ethnicity matter, particularly for groups like the Hazaras who've been targeted, you know, for their ethnic and sectarian identities, for their physical appearance, for their, you know, level of education, for their historic wrong and in Afghan social hierarchy. So there are really a host of elements that come together, not least of which, you know, we might highlight the role of class. A lot of choices have been made, you know, given, depending on one's proximity to American power, you know, to the NGO world, and all the things that came with, you know, material benefits have been important, you know, housing, transportation, you know, access to education, access now to a passport, all these crucial things, which are really, you know, coming down to kind of life and death opportunities, had a lot to do with, you know, where you stood in relation to various international actors over the last two decades. So I'd say that, you know, Afghan politics are extremely complex, but some of the categories that we bring to other histories and other contemporary political scenes are also relevant here. You know, again, class, ethnicity, religious outlook, political affiliation, you know, alongside what we might call tribe or ethnicity. So it's really, I guess it's a very dynamic picture that is more familiar, I think, than we're often told. I think, you know, audiences who follow American politics, who follow European politics, will see a lot in this story and see a lot in the competing forces, which are, you know, familiar to them. And I would say in this, the current landscape, I mean, the, you know, the people who call themselves in the Afghan context, the representatives of the Republic, that is kind of trying to carve out, especially in the last year or so, carve out a space that, you know, is against the Taliban, but is also highly critical and really in some quarters, vociferously opposed to the Ashraf Ghani government and, you know, their foreign ties, their foreign passports, their dual citizenship, their property in Dubai, their corruption, all these factors. So there's a public has emerged that is quite interesting because it's, I think it's been overlooked and it's not reducible to being pro-American or pro-liberal democracy or pro-human rights. Actually, we can find people across the spectrum, some of whom are, you know, Islamist and wary of American human rights talk or Western human rights talk, but who want to be engaged in Afghan politics, who want a voice. And I think what's striking is that given this pluralistic landscape of people who want different things, the one thing that unites them has been hostility both to the Taliban and to the Ashraf Ghani government and its foreign backers. So the question now, I think, for me at least, is you know, what will happen to this generation? And it's very much a generational phenomenon, not exclusively, but very much a question of youth. You know, what will happen to these young voices who have sacrificed so much, who've had so much hope in international backing for university education, for human rights projects, and for, you know, gender equality, or at least something like that, you know, at least the, if not gender equality, then the right to go to school, to go to pursue higher education, to pursue work outside the home. I mean, all that now is has been left in question. And I think the society is going to have, you know, some say in Afghanistan's future, even though the Taliban rule the streets. I think the Taliban will depend on them to some extent to run a state. And also there's, I mean, I think immense potential to resist Taliban rule, you know, if not overtly through kind of, you know, armed opposition, through all kinds of things that, you know, historians have emphasized in other societies where in an unequal fight, you know, the weaker parties can often exert some kind of power in shaping the destiny of the country. So I think much of that is left, you know, left to be seen. And I think this is really a window, given very few other options for the international community, as far as that exists as a real actor, to press the Taliban to rule in a way that gives some space to these younger voices and to, you know, make some accommodation of this budding generation that, you know, that wanted some kind of pluralism, that wants different things. And as I hear from some of my friends and, you know, acquaintances, they point out, especially, you know, among women, you know, they say, you know, we didn't ask for this. We didn't ask the Taliban to be here. Some of them are quite young. I mean, they were 2 years old, 3 years old, the last time the Taliban ruled. They've grown up in an entirely different setting. Again, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't all American created, but I think many Afghans did create a kind of civil society. And this wasn't just Kabul. I mean, I know Kabul, it's most evident, but I think even in some of the provinces, there were younger voices who really, really wanted higher education and really wanted a kind of cosmopolitan life with access to a world beyond their immediate horizons. And all that, you know, it appears to have been dashed. And so I think this is one, you know, one avenue that the national community can pursue to really amplify the voices somehow, to draw them into some kind of status, because I think the fate of society will depend upon, you know, having doctors, having working women, having medical services, having all things that will make, you know, a financial system. You know, all this stuff I think is beyond, you know, really the capacity of the Taliban as a state. So I think that is really one of the last areas where international actors might have some influence here.
So I'm always reminded there's a tendency of contemporary political commentators, and in some cases, international relations scholars, to say, you know, simply put, or to boil this down, it's about this. And the historians usually say, no, actually, it's quite complicated. And I think, you know, Bob's comment sort of highlighting that this narrative that the Taliban are poised to take control. They will take control, they will govern the country, and we know how they're going to govern it because they governed it in the 90s. But there's much more complexity to that, including the last, you know, 20 years of development, which then leaves sort of my last question here. I think I'm going to direct this at Amin, but Allah, you all can respond to this. This is a conflict that is being described as sort of being over and the Taliban have won when the U.S. withdraws. But the attacks by ISKP and the potential for ethnic conflict, et cetera, suggests that this conflict is far from over. Is the conflict far from over, or are we going to see a relatively stable resolution once the United States leaves? I'll ask you.
I think it depends partially. The opposition to the Taliban cannot survive without support from outside. It's impossible. And if they can manage to have their relationship, the Taliban, good relationship with the Central Asians, with China, with Russia, the Iranians already are on board, and they don't become too disruptive and too anti-Shia, and I think they have a chance to muddle along. However, and deal with the terrorism inside. They're pretty brutal with the ISKP, when, you know, so they know each other well in that sense. They will do things that a foreign country would not do. So I think the key here is how the Taliban manage. The Taliban are not monolithic. They've never been, and that they are not now. Some of the group have become very sophisticated. They have been in Kremlin, they have been in Beijing, they have talked with Pompeo, they have talked with everybody. They understand how to do politics. And if they come get the upper hand, Mullah Baradar and people like that, then I think the Taliban could muddle along. As long as they don't irk the Afghans too much. Just 3-4 days ago, they celebrated Ashura, which is the high point of Shia religious festival, commemorating the martyrdom or death of Hussein. This would have been unthinkable a few years ago. So if they continue that, I think they can muddle along. But the problem is, if they don't, and the opposition is created and some other countries can help them, then again, Afghanistan unfortunately falls into another civil war, and who knows, sucks in Central Asia. I think the country that should watch this the most, and I'll stop it here, is Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Pakistan is right now think they have victory, but I think the country that is the most in danger right now is Pakistan.
In time, we have about a minute and a half left. I'll give you the last word.
Let me just tell you what my horror scenario is. I think I agree with most of the things that Amin talked about, but there is still a possibility of a large civil war. And that could be absolutely disastrous because, you know, it's not inconceivable that if there's a large civil war, you couldn't have a number of regional interlopers also join, including Iran, China, Russia, Pakistan, India. And of course, that's the horror story. And I don't think that's inconceivable. I recognize that the resistance controls Panjshir right now, and that's not large enough. But, you know, an expanded civil war is my real fear.
Thank you very much. We've been discussing the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan and the U.S. withdrawal. Our panel today has been Amin Tarzai, Director of Middle East Studies at the Marine Corps University. He's the author of Islamic State, Khorasan Province, in The Future of ISIS. Thomas Johnson, research professor of the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval Postgraduate School, as well as the director of the Program for Culture and Conflict Studies. He's the author of Taliban Narratives, The Uses of Power and Power of Stories in the Afghanistan Conflict. Robert Cruz, professor of history at Stanford University, and the author of Afghan Modern, The History of a Global Nation. And Steve Swerdlow, associate professor of the practice at the University of Southern California, and senior Central Asia researcher at Human Rights Watch. He's conducted extensive fieldwork internationally with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. Thank you all very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.